Whitechapel met Springtime. We gaan eruit met American Motors, drie muzikanten die al in massa's andere bands speelden en met al hun ervaring na amper een jaar een debuutplaat klaar hebben. Content. Een beetje atypische postpunk met een nogal specifieke stem. Hier is nog Tamrak van American Motors. Veel plezier met sterrenplaten. Zometeen zijn we Gonzo Circus te gast en tot volgende week.
That was Christmas from their third and last album, Lies to Live By. That was Beyond the Fields We Know. Before that, Dr. Z with a track called Too Well Satisfied. And before that, the Spiders from Mexico. And now, from Japan, is this Chinky Chen and his friends. And let's play a track called Farewell to Hippocrates.
shotguns on your back now. Don't shoot 'em right down. Don't shoot 'em right down now. With the shotguns on your back now. With the shotguns on your back now. Well, what kind of conservative running downtown with a crazy mind? What kind of conservative running downtown with a crazy mind? On down, 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 here we go now. Down, 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 here we go now. Don't shoot 'em right down. Don't shoot 'em right down. With the shotguns on your back now. With the shotguns on your back now. Blue collar, ready go. Guns on your back now. Down, down, down in your fist now. Down, down, down in your brain now. Down, down, down in your body now. One got it, conservative. Running down, 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 down we go. Down, 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 here we go now. Down, 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 here my friends go. Down, 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 here my friends. Don't shoot 'em right down. Don't shoot 'em right down now. Down, 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 here we go now.
Chinky Shan and his friends, that's with Farewell to Hypocrisis. And now let's play a record from former Yugoslavia by Grupa 220. It's from their album Slike. Let's play a track called Čovjek.
Episode 1. On the night of the 21st of January 1919, the Russian inventor, physicist and polymath Nikita Slavkin vanished. In the months and years that followed, the Soviet press reported that the socialization capsule, Slavkin's latest invention, represented an extraordinary advance in human knowledge. Slavkin, building on the theories of his hero Einstein, had revolutionized our understanding of the universe. What's more, his disappearance was proof that his theories had a practical application. He had found a means of subverting time itself. The vanishing futurist, as he was dubbed, became a Soviet icon. Monuments and streets were named after him, biographies written, children's books, portraits, films. No word has been heard from him since that day. Yet the idea persists that one day he will reappear. In May 1914, much against the advice of my parents, I took up the post of governess to the Korbelev family at number 7 Gargarinsky Lane, Moscow. My new house was a large, ramshackle building in need of a good coat of paint. It was reddish-brown, with a hefty, slightly sagging façade of white columns and pediment. On the other three sides leaned a mass of shabby outbuildings and an overgrown lilac hedge. As I put my head out of the carriage, my first impression was of the dizzying scent of lilac and the heavy branches of pale, wet blossom gleaming in the half-light. My second was of a surprisingly deep and oily puddle into which I immediately stepped. I include these details because now that I sit down to piece together these memoirs, it strikes me that they give a rather accurate shorthand of my life with the Korbelevs. Before I left my home in Cornwall, my parents and their friends had informed me at length of the mistake I was making. Russia was generally held to be a country of wild Cossacks, bears, anarchists, and so forth. My father would never have given his permission if it had not been for the fact that the introduction came through the redoubtable Miss Clegg, a solid, leathery woman, as dependably stuffed with good chapel values as a pasty is with potato, despite the fact that she'd been working as a governess in Moscow for almost a decade. From that first auspicious whiff of lilac, there was something irresistible about the Korbelev household. The front door swung open to reveal a large, dusty, red-papered hall and the colossal rear view of a footman in brown and gold livery. Without looking round, he held the door open with one hand and with the other cupped his mouth so that his voice would carry further. "Priekala mis!" he bellowed. "The miss has arrived." Immediately the servants began to appear in the hall, as if they'd been hiding behind doors in anticipation. A plump young woman with her hair in a turban, a little younger than myself, arrived, frowning. "Miss Freely, I'm Sonia Korbelev. Welcome." She gave me her hand with a limp, regal air that confused me. As I shook it, it occurred to me that perhaps she'd expected it to be kissed. "This is my younger brother, Pasha." "How do you do, Miss Freely?" A young man with a conspicuously well-tended moustache came up behind her, smiling. "Pleased to welcome you to our abode. As you can perhaps tell, I have already completed my school certificate in English, thanks to a Miss Edie Campbell from Melrose." "She must have been an excellent teacher." "I hate to correct you, but you probably mean she's done a grand job, don't you?" "Oh, for goodness sake, Pasha, don't start teasing her already," snapped Sonia. "Ah, here come your charges, Miss Freely. My youngest brother and sister, Dima and Lisa." They arrived, panting and grinning. A solid fair-haired boy and a taller, skinny girl with plaits. "Miss Freely, do come this way," Sonia said. "My father is looking forward to meeting you." Dima put his hand in mine. In the study, Mr. Korbeliev, a tall, slight man with a grey streaked beard, came forward to greet me. "Welcome, welcome. My dear Miss Freely, sit down with us, drink some tea. You must be tired." I took a seat. As the room was painted dark green, full of smoke and unlit, I could barely see who was opposite me. At last I made out two ancient ladies, the old governess, Mademoiselle, and Mr. Korbeliev's aunt, Anna Vladimirovna, behind a large brass samovar, bobbing their heads and smiling at me. I bobbed and smiled back, and they waggled their heads all the more energetically. Pasha came to my rescue, murmuring at me to stop first. "Otherwise, you could be nodding at each other for days." "Is that why the last governess left?"
"Yes. A very sad business. In the end, her head fell off."
"Is she ill?" the aunt said loudly to Mr. Korbeliev in French. "She's making barbaric noises." "No, no, aunt. Soyez tranquille." He leant across to talk to me. He was in his late 50s, I supposed, but seemed younger, with the same dark brown eyes as Pasha. He pulled Dima to him and stroked his cheek. "They are good children, though perhaps a little wild, eh, you monkeys?" "You see, Miss Freely, their poor mother is ill, and I'm very often away on business. They've not had an easy childhood." "My mother has neurasthenia," Sonia said. "She has to stay in bed most days, although now and again she manages a meal downstairs. If there's anything you need, my father is the one to approach. Now, let me show you to your room." Governesses are famously long-lived. When I met her in 1914, the Korbeliev's retired governess, Mademoiselle, was in her mid-80s, timid and furry as a vole, and still running errands for the whole family. As I write this, I am not far from 80 myself. A whole lifetime has passed since I went to Russia. My daughter Sophie has grown up sons of her own. My husband, Paul, died 6 months ago, and since then I have the strange sensation that the present, my creaky old body in the little terraced house in Hackney which we bought together, is no longer my home. For several months, Sophie has been trying to persuade me to clear the attic of a lifetime of accumulated papers, and I have been feebly resisting. She is quite right that it must be done, of course. I know that. I'm merely taking a moment to gird up my loins before I dredge Slavkin's story up from its decades of silence. Last week, Sophie, running out of patience, hauled several boxes down and left them by my chair. "Have a look through, Mama. And on Saturday I can throw out what you don't want to keep." All week I rehearse how I'm going to open the conversation with Sophie. Paul wanted us to tell her everything years ago, but I persuaded him it would be too confusing, too painful. And now he's gone, it is frankly a worse moment than ever to begin. But I have no choice. I find myself writing an account for her instead, using the papers as my starting point. This way, I think, will be more truthful. We were at the Korbeliev's country estate, Mikhailovka, when the war began. I remember so vividly where we were sitting, looking down to the bend in the stream where the cattle were drinking. Mr. Korbeliev stepped out onto the veranda, rubbing his forehead. "Dears, it has happened. Russia has declared war on Germany." The prospect of war had been hanging over us, and we felt a sort of ghastly relief when it was finally announced. I thought about, but dismissed the idea of going home. I was enjoying myself, and like everyone, I was convinced that it would be a short war. Nikita Slavkin sat a little apart from Pasha's other friends, arms wrapped around his long, knobbly legs, pale and awkward. He had very short, almost colourless hair that revealed a bumpy scalp, slightly protuberant pale blue eyes. When the conversation turned to women's rights, Pasha drew him in. "Nikita here has some ideas, don't you, Nikita? He's inventing all sorts of contraptions that will change women's lives, and all our lives. Come over here, tell us." Nikita stood upright. He was absurdly tall and skinny, and blushed even under his hair. When he spoke, his voice was strangely deep and a little too loud. He looked embarrassed by that too. Well, one of my inventions is a lightweight chastity belt woven out of steel thread. The room erupted into protest. Everyone was disgusted, either on liberal, conservative or squeamish grounds. Mr. Korbeliev's aunt, Anna Vladimirovna, wanted him thrown out of the house. Pasha laughed so much he fell off the divan. Slavkin stood there, his large hands hanging by his sides, vulnerable. Of course I have not perfected the material yet. A neighbour of the Korbeliev's, Marina Gertler, who was studying medicine, looked as though she might punch him. Don't you see? Modern women need freedom, she hissed. His full, pale lips trembled a little. I do see, yes, he muttered. That's my aim. Slavkin had just moved into the small bedroom next to mine, which Mr. Korbeliev had offered him in exchange for a few hours' work a week on his catalogue. At 22, the same age as me, he was 4 years older than Pasha and seemed a decade wiser. A scholarship student from Siberia, studying physics and engineering at Moscow University, he was already known to many of the artists and poets in the avant-garde for his inventions, which he claimed would drive forward the steamer of modernity. But he was not, at first, a popular addition to Gagarinsky Lane. Sonya made it clear that she found Slavkin uncouth, while Anna Vladimirovna claimed his village voice gave her headaches. The loyal Pasha, however, wouldn't hear a word said against his friend. He teased Sonya and Anna Vladimirovna about their attitude, which he claimed was a medical condition, snobbosis. The two young men were inseparable. It was Pasha who gave Nikita the nickname Camel. Legs and eyelashes, he explained. Although he also described Nikita as a mythical creature, half Moses and half the camel he rode on, with a heart made entirely of little fluffy puppies. As I read my letters, I strain to catch again a whiff of the stuffy, overheated air of Mr. Korbeliev's dark green study, lit by the rosy glow of the large fringed brass lamps. His ethnographic collection spread over every surface, and the high-backed red divan crammed with shining, excitable faces shouting each other down. Slavkin showing us his new inventions one after the other, billows of smoke hovering in the light, shrouding Mr. Korbeliev's expression, and Mamselle, the old governess, smiling timidly on the edge of things. Music cranked out of the gramophone, and me at the samovar, dark-haired, pale, with serious grey eyes. Still a little shy, frowning in concentration as I add the hot water. Those three pre-revolutionary years were my university. At home, for all my minor rebellions, I had never dreamt of challenging my parents' articles of faith. Any note of discord roused my father to spittle-laden fury. In Moscow, I discovered a household where the most absurd and opposing views could be voiced, disagreed with, argued over, or renounced without any tempers lost or touchy chapel gods invoked. Episode 2. In the autumn of 1915, Lisa, and a year later, Dima, began to study at secondary school. Travel to Britain was still out of the question, however, so I stayed on with the Korbeliev's, as all their former employees appeared to do. I caught a tram each morning up the Boulevard Ring to a school on Terskaya Street, where I gave English lessons, and walk the children back from school in the afternoon. The post became erratic, and communication with my parents infrequent. What, after all, had I left behind in Britain? My brothers had moved away, and all that awaited me in Truro was my father, who seemed to dislike me, and my mother, who thought me unnatural. At home, my mother used to bewail unanswerably, "What are we to do with you?" In Moscow, I felt I'd found a reply for her. Then, in November 1916, I received a letter through the diplomatic bag in my father's dark, decisive hand. "Dear Gertrude, it is with profound sadness that I write to tell you that your brother Edmund has been killed in action on the Somme at Ancre on the night of 16th-17th October. I suppose it was unfair of me to blame my parents for Edmund's death. Even if they did encourage him to join up, they'd done no more than millions of other families. And yet, as I reread that letter now, I feel a rush of the rage I harboured against them for years. I never wanted to see them again. I ripped up their unread letters. I hid in my room to cry, too angry to accept sympathy. All true socialists take a defeatist position," said Pasha that winter, the first time I'd heard the term. "This war was inevitable. A result of empire, colonial policies produce an excess of weapons, raw materials and manufactured produce. Then they need a war to soak up the glut and keep the prices high. And the irony is, because the result can only be chaos and the destabilization of the regime, it's bringing the revolution closer every day." "Pasha!" I was so angry I shook all over. "I never thought I would hear you say such a disgraceful, cynical thing. If the revolution depends on the death of innocent young men, it isn't worth a jot." "Oh, Gertie, I'm sorry." He came towards me, but I rushed out of the room. It was Nikita Slavkin who set things right, knocking on my door late at night. "Miss Gertie, may I talk to you? I think you misunderstood." "Do you? Please, let me explain. We socialists would abolish war entirely. And we agree that the blood of a single human being is more valuable than any notions of patriotism." He sat down, not looking at me. "It's primitive behaviour. My mother died just as stupidly for no reason at all, of a minor infection after childbirth. My father would not take her to the hospital. He sat and prayed over her. If she'd been treated, she would still be alive." He said gently, "At least let your brother's death mean something. Revolution will redeem all these sacrifices." Slavkin had grown in authority over the past couple of years. We often found ourselves turning to him for the final word. It struck me that his childhood in an old believer community, a type of strict orthodox sect, had much in common with my own chapel upbringing. We had both jettisoned a cruel, overweening God, yet against our will we were both left with a sense of loss. We rejected the Father, but we could not rid ourselves of the beauty of the Son's example, or a belief in the unity of all things. I signed up for a course in political education, yet politics always remained opaque to me, however hard I tried. Revolution, on the other hand, or at least the revolution that Slavkin envisaged, was clearly visible. It was the longed-for precipice just downhill of us. On the 3rd of March, Mr. Korbeliev arrived back from his club out of breath, his face scarlet, his eyes full of tears, with the news that the Tsar had abdicated. We embraced each other, cried and rushed out onto the streets, swept up on the general tide of euphoria. It all happened more or less just as a revolution should, with dozens of symbolic moments, the burning of the Tsarist regalia, huge demonstrations in the streets, exultant groups of citizens drinking the contents of a few looted stores. October had none of the ingredients of a people's revolution. No processions and no symbolic removal of the tyrant's flag, because there was no tyrant by then. There was street fighting in Moscow, but thank goodness not too close to Gagarinsky Lane. In late October, I remember, snow threatened but did not come. Mr. Korbeliev telephoned friends of his in the city council and learnt that the Bolsheviks had driven out the provisional government. We could hear heavy fighting in other parts of the city, so we settled in at Gagarinsky Lane and played card games with the children, to pass the time. After 5 days, it finally began to snow, and the city fell quiet. Pasha and Nikita were keen to find out news, and I volunteered to go with them. We turned towards the centre of town. Pasha and Nikita were deep in conversation and did not include me. It was the middle of the afternoon, but the streets were almost empty. On Mokhovaya Street, Pasha said, "What's that?" And we saw the body of a man in the road. From the way he was lying, awkwardly, his leg bent beneath him, it was clear from a distance of 50 yards that he was dead. Snow had already settled on his face and his clothes. The three of us passed him on the other side of the road. We did not say another word about it. But after a few moments, I realised that we were on Vujdevanshankar. "Perhaps," my voice came out in a croak. I cleared my throat and tried again. "Perhaps we might drop in and see Miss Clegg and the Beloborodovs." "Yes, yes," agreed Pasha with relief. And Slavkin, as if noticing that I was with them for the first time, turned to me, smiled and nodded. I felt an absurd self-congratulatory flush. We entered the Beloborodovs' large, modern apartment, and Miss Clegg brought us into the drawing-room to join the family. Monsieur Beloborodov was talking with his brother-in-law, Prince Svetinsky, in front of the fireplace. Madame was quite young, although she adopted the glorious condescending airs of a dowager. "Little Miss Freely," she drawled from her chair, "do sit down with us." We drank weak tea from little porcelain cups and spoke of this and that. Prince Svetinsky, who is a collector of minerals, spoke of a rare specimen, Jeremijevite, that he had found for sale in the market. Slavkin perked up. "I thought only a few examples were known." The prince's little black eyes fell on Slavkin. "Are you interested in minerals? You must let me show you my collection." They fell into conversation.
"Is your friend at the university?" murmured Madame Beloborodov.
"Yes, he's studying physics and engineering, but he also attends lectures in the geology faculty. He seems to know all the professors."
"Really?
Prince Svetinsky and his wife have had some bad luck. A fire in his house, on Miznitskaya. His collection, thank heavens, was unharmed. Now they plan to sell it and leave for France."
"I see," I replied slowly, wondering why I was being favoured with this confidence.
"Perhaps," she breathed scarcely audibly to me, "your friend might have connections in the university who would be interested."
A few weeks later, we spent several days packing and sorting the pieces at the prince's house. I was finishing up a last few tasks when the prince came up to the gallery for the first time. He went straight to his study without greeting us, and Nikita immediately hurried over to speak to him. I could not see the prince, who is concealed behind the door of his study, or hear their conversation, yet I read its course clearly in the lines of Nikita's body. He plucked nervously at his sleeve and shuffled from foot to foot, backing away from the fury directed at him. He shook his head.
Now the prince raised his voice. "Robbery! They never had the slightest intention to pay!"
Nikita, cowering before him, still shook his head. "That wasn't what we arranged. I had no idea." He flinched as though he'd been hit. The study door slammed shut. He walked slowly back towards me. "He says they forced him to sign the collection over to the state." We set out through the darkening streets towards Gagarinsky Lane, and he went over and over the episode. "I suppose now the collection will be at the service of the people," I said at last, timidly. He looked at me for a moment, as if about to say something, then changed his mind. He stood up a little straighter, then quite unexpectedly he took my arm and tucked it under his slow, sweet smile, lighting up his face.
"Gertie, I think you must be the most rational, sensible woman I know," he said.
We walked together through the icy streets and past the central post office, pockmarked with bullet holes. His arm felt very warm against mine.
The Svetinskys donated their collection to the Soviet state against their will.
and in return were permitted to leave for France. The Svertinsky theft, as the episode became known in émigré circles, brought Slavkin the approval of the Bolshevik leadership and a position at the newly established Centre for Revolutionary Research, where he began his work on iridium alloys, the first step towards the socialisation capsule. One May evening in 1918, I couldn't sleep. I leaned out of the open window, gazing into the dark spring night. A car, its headlights extinguished, cruised quietly down Gagarinsky Lane. Underneath my window, it stopped, and several men jumped out. They ran up to the gate and banged loudly. This was not the first time that the house had been searched, but the other occasions had been in daylight, and we'd had some warning to hide incriminating possessions. I darted along to Mr. Korbeliff's study. His gun, a Mauser, was lying quite openly on the sideboard. People were shot for less. I thrust it into my bodice, then ran to Mrs. Korbeliff's room. "Wake up, Sofia Pavlovna, dear. The militia are here," I said, shaking her. "Give me your jewels, quickly." She sat up and fumbled in the chest of drawers by her bed, pulling out several velvet bags. I could hear voices in the hall downstairs shouting for Comrade Korbeliff. "He's at work," Pasha told them. I peeped over the banisters. There were perhaps four or five of them, swaggering and nervous. One of them casually swept the large china letter dish off the hall table. It chimed like a bell as it smashed. "Who are you?" said Pasha. "Show me your identification." "Comrade Korbeliff, I'm the deputy head of the Smolensk District Soviet." A man pushed forward to talk to Pasha. I saw it was Prigorian, who had been the Korbeliff chauffeur until the car was requisitioned. He'd always been the image of deference. And now he stood with his legs apart and rested his hand on his gun holster at his belt. "The people are concerned that your father has been carrying off the treasures he expropriated from the nation." "Do you mean his collection?" I was impressed by Pasha's calm tones. "You know perfectly well, Prig. Nothing has been carried off. My father has preserved large numbers of works of art for the Russian people." "Search the house," Prig told the others, without looking around. Episode 3. They moved towards the stairs, and I ran to my bedroom and shoved the jewels and gun under my mattress. My heart was thrashing about in my chest. Voices were raised. There was a crash of a table being overturned. "Open up, or we'll arrest you all," I could hear them saying outside Mrs. Korbeliff's room. I waited in my room. "Open up! Open up at once!" They thumped on my door. "Certainly not," I said in my most haughty tones. "I am a British citizen. You have no right to search my room." I opened the door a sliver and showed them my passport. In silence, they examined it, one after the other. Prig was called. "It's true. She's an Anglichanka," he said, looking at me distastefully. To my amazement, they moved on. Half an hour later, they were gone. When Mr. Korbeliff returned home, I went to see him in his study. For the first time since I'd lived in the house, Mrs. Korbeliff was sitting with him. I gave them back their belongings. "Good Lord, Miss Gertie, how can we thank you?" "No, no, don't thank me. But, sir, is it safe for you all here in Moscow?" "I've always said the moral course is to remain," Korbeliff began, then checked himself, looking at his wife. I don't know." Mrs. Korbeliff, very pale but upright, suddenly spoke. "I think we should go south for the summer. Will you accompany us, Miss Gertie?" "No, Sofia Pavlovna, I must stay in Moscow," I told her gently. The embassy had advised British citizens to remain in the capital in case of evacuation. "But perhaps you'd like me to protect the house as far as possible?" We spent the next 3 days packing away Mr. Korbeliff's ethnographic collection. Then we hired a cart and transported them to the Alexander III Museum, which had agreed to store the collection. Mr. Korbelev had procured tickets for them to Yalta. Sonia's husband had returned to Petrograd. Sonia herself decided to accompany her parents south, but the old ladies refused to move. Mr. Korbelev was in despair. No argument would change their minds, and as I promised to care for them as best I could, Mr. Korbelev finally agreed they should remain. He insisted on leaving me the Mauser, which I took with some trepidation, having no idea how to load or fire it. It was another lilac-scented day in May when the old carriage was loaded up and a horse was hired to take them to the station. "Goodbye, Miss Gertie," said Pasha, doffing his cap and grinning at me. "Now I'll never be able to convince you how much I love you." I laughed. "Pasha, you are ridiculous." I stopped. He had already turned away and was talking to Yasha, telling him to drive on. In the end, the Korbelev family left the house on Gargorinsky Lane almost without noticing, talking and arguing among themselves. I was working longer hours than ever at the English school on Terskaya, lessons that were now paid mainly in kind. One pupil, a Georgian, presented me with a bag of good black tea. All the old ladies were happy. "Take some, do, to that strange boy," said Anna Vladimirovna. At my knock, Slavkin opened his door, even a little too quickly, as though he were waiting for me, and made me jump, and some of the precious tea was spilt. I had never seen the inside of his room. The walls were covered in notes and equations, pieces of newspaper, scribbles, and rather beautiful sketches. In one corner was a camera on a tripod, and in another a heap of rubbish. Broken wooden crates, bits of old planking, dirty bottles, rags, stones. "Goodness," I said. "This is your work?" I was conscious of a note of incredulity and added, "Perhaps one day you will explain it to me." I turned to leave, embarrassed. "Wait." He took a step towards me. "Why are you here? Why didn't you go somewhere?